Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor in Information Technology and Management at Babson College and co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning. Professor Davenport, in a November 2009 Harvard Business Review article entitled Make Better Decisions, you note that in recent years, decision makers in both the public and private sectors have made a number of bad calls. Would you tell us more about this apparent decision-making disorder? And what about the need to formalize decision alternative mechanisms?
Sure. You know, I was thinking about this recently. I teach a course at Babson to MBA students on decision making, and one of the cases we looked at was the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, and then we try to talk about the invasion of Iraq as well. You know, I had them watch the movie W, which is, you know, we don't have great data on what decision processes were used, but it's all kind of depressing in a way, because we seem to use a bad decision-making process in 1961, and we seem to use a bad decision-making process 45 years later with regard to Iraq. And so government has not cornered the market on bad decisions. As we know from the financial crisis, a lot of really bad decision-making in that regard. So my hope in that article and my work on decision-making was to get people to think about, if we're making all these bad decisions, maybe we should start taking a systematic look at how we do decision making. One of the other somewhat depressing thoughts is I went back and looked at, when did the idea of groupthink get first identified by an academic? And it's about 50 years ago or so. Yet I don't think we've necessarily gotten any better in avoiding groupthink. We have all these ideas, these learnings about decision processes, but they don't really make it into the decision-making processes of many organizations. And so I've been trying to go a little bit beyond analytics and saying, okay, you know, maybe you have some analytics, maybe you don't, but how do you really systematically improve how you make decisions? And I think it should work in both public and private sectors.
Many organizations continually re-engineer their business processes. Why do you see few organizations re-engineering their decision-making capability?
I think there are a variety of reasons. One, we've typically viewed decision-making as the province of senior executives. You know, George W. Bush said, I'm the decider, and, you know, that's kind of my bailiwick, and stay out of it. And I think there's been that implicit kind of assumption for a lot of other people. There are a lot of new approaches to decision making that may not have been digested. The whole idea of behavioral economics, which is just making its way into the public sector now. You have Cass Sunstein as the czar of regulation now, who has written a book about this subject called Nudge. But it's still early. I think analytics are not well known to many people. What some of the things we're learning from neuroscience, I think, are not widely known about the role of emotion in decision making, for example, the intuition versus analysis kind of distinction. So a lot of new content that may not have been digested yet. Anyway, that's what I'm hoping.
Well, you outline a framework in the article for improving decision making. Would you elaborate on that framework?
Sure. So it's a 4I framework. It's not like Delta. It's not an acronym. But the first I is really to identify what are your key decisions. I mean, when I go around and talk to organizations, I say, you know, do you know what your top 10 or top 15 or top 20 decisions are? And very few do. And, you know, I think we can't make all of them better. So we should identify which ones, both a strategic perspective and an operational perspective, which ones are really critical to our effective performance. So then for those, you start taking a look at them, and I call that the inventory stage. So how well are they made today on average? How long do they take? Who's involved in them? You know, get a sense of how broken they are, how much opportunity there is for improvement, if you will. And then the third stage is to intervene in them. And maybe the difficult thing these days is there are a lot of possible interventions that most organizations haven't taken advantage of. You know, one being if we're going to do a lot of that particular decision, we can automate it to some degrees. And that's one of the things that the Social Security Administration is doing with regard to disability claims. If it seems like a clear, open and shut case that a person has a disability and we want to get it through the system very quickly, might as well make that decision in an automated or at least a semi-automated fashion so you can get it done. I think IBM has been working with them on that particular project. Another would be just to think about who's involved in the decision and should it be a little bit broader. One of the things the Obama administration is trying to do is to get more, you know, public input into decision making. Another would be thinking about, you know, the mix of emotion and intuition and rationality in it. So there's some decisions like moral decisions that emotion seems to be absolutely essential to. If people lose the emotional part of their brain, they can't make those decisions at all. Whereas other decisions for which there's data available and for which, you know, the stakes are high really probably should not be purely intuition based. So the intervention step is really stepping back and saying, what can we do to make this decision better? And then finally, there's an institutionalization process to say, okay, if we really care about making decisions better, what are the things we can put in place, like a set of decision analysts or coaches, like a process for looking back at how decisions turn out that could really make us get better at this over the long run.
So are there organizations that have employed better decision or overhauled the decision-making process that you would like to elaborate on?
There are. I mean, I've certainly been able to find people who have done at least one of those steps. In the article, I talk about Stanley Works, which you're probably all familiar with. You know, they make hammers and rakes and tools and so on. And they certainly did the identification step. They identified pricing as a really key factor. It's true for almost any private sector firm, but most haven't really done a systematic analysis of pricing. They looked at how the process of pricing worked so far. Their interventions were really multifaceted. I think that's one of the keys. So they established a pricing center of excellence. They put in some pricing optimization software. They hired some contractors to get competitor pricing. They put in some meetings where different parts of the company would share how their pricing was going. And fantastically successful. Over 6 years, they improved their gross margin, their profit margins by 6%, which is really huge. And, you know, maybe that's why they were able to buy Black & Decker, which we learned about a few weeks ago, because they've just been really successful at doing this. So they're an example of an organization that really went through all of those stages, and they even have institutionalized it by continuing to get better, looking at their pricing successes and failures. They have the Pricing Center of Excellence kind of shares knowledge around the organization of what different groups are doing. So I think very successful. Chevron sound like a fair amount of money, but every decision over $100 million in their oil business has to go through a regular decision analysis, has to be looked at afterwards to see how did it work out in a kind of a non-recriminatory atmosphere. So not as many probably in the public sector, although the Army was really good for a while at learning from its experience and kind of doing lookbacks, if you will, at key initiatives in the field to see, you know, what might we have done better. So there are aspects of it that have been done in the public sector as well.
In the new landscape of decision making, ancient approaches have recently been augmented by improvements in technology and new research. Would you briefly outline these approaches and describe the strengths and weaknesses of each?
Sure. I have a chart in that article, which I can remember some of anyway. So there is that old favorite, intuition. And intuition, it turns out, is very helpful under a couple of circumstances. One, when you can't use any other approach. Two, when it's really doesn't matter that much. You're trying to decide what kind of ice cream to get. You probably don't need a regression equation. And three, when you have a lot of experience. So I recently debated Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote this book, Blink, about, I think, kind of glorifying intuition, although he argued that it didn't. But He said he's really talking about cases where people have a lot of experience, and then it can be a very useful guide. It's almost like you've internalized that quantitative analysis in a way. Then there are analytics, which are great if you can get the data, if you can take the time. It's usually a somewhat time-consuming exercise to develop an analytical model, and you find that when you do that, the decisions tend to be better and more accurate if you use analytics. I mentioned behavioral economics before. I think we're just starting to think about that. Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein in their book have a concept they call choice architecture, which says that, you know, there are certain decisions that we make that are going to be influenced by somebody. Their example is if you're a kid at school going through the cafeteria line, and you're the cafeteria manager, should you put the apples in the most prominent position or the cookies? Now, the cookies are probably going to get picked up anyway, to some degree, by the kids. You might as well put the apples in the most prominent position because something has to be there. So they use a lot of examples. Behavioral economics research is suggesting that in 401k programs, if you just make people opt out instead of opt in, you get a lot higher participation. So that's kind of the idea of behavioral economics and choice architecture. In neuroscience, I think we're learning that there are certain types of decisions that we typically make well, but others we don't make well. Complex financial decisions, our brains are not quite up to the task, it seems. And that probably has something to do with the fact that, you know, we took all these subprime mortgages and didn't really calculate that they were going to come back to bite us in the rear, when the low introductory rate ran out. Our brains are not good at that kind of decision, and so we really shouldn't entrust it just to our brains. And we would hope that policymakers would kind of protect us from ourselves in that regard.
Well, actually, that's a good point, because you do mention the decisions to invest in securitized subprime mortgages and hedge risk with credit default swaps. To what extent were those decisions less about properly using analytics and more about the ethical and fiduciary behavior of those actors?
Well, I think it's probably some of both. I'm sure, and I've read a fair amount about this, that there was some belief that people were not going to be able to pay these loans back. And so it's kind of a short-sighted decision, at least, if not immoral, to make all these kinds of loans. People were compensated for making them anyway, which is unfortunate. But I think the analytics, it's not that the analytics were wrong, but they were not properly used in a lot of cases. It's kind of the thing about analytics and predictive models in particular is they're mostly based on the past. If you think that the past will be a good guide to the future, then analytics are great. If you think there's something changing in the world that makes the past not a very good guide to the future anymore, then you need to really change your analytical models. And so what happened, particularly in the housing space, is that what had been true for the last couple of decades stopped being true around 2007 or so, and most organizations didn't realize it quickly enough to adapt and didn't have the assumptions written down in their models that said this only works when housing prices go up. In fact, there were some models that would not take a negative value for housing price over time. It's just increases were part of the natural order of things, it was assumed, and they couldn't really put in anything else. So that's clearly not a good model.
How do you balance and augment decision tools like modeling with human intuition and judgment?
Well, that's a real interest of mine. And I think there are some things that analytics are really good at, but there's some things that humans are really good at. And analytics are not really good at knowing when they don't apply anymore. And computers obviously are doing that work, and they are not going to give you a recommendation. Please turn me off. You know, the conditions no longer prevail that I can make a decision well here. So humans are good at that kind of big picture thinking and kind of noticing changes in the environment. And so we should use our brains for that kind of purpose. There's an airline pilot who's a friend of mine who I sometimes go sailing with. And he was one day telling me, we were talking about analytics, and he said, oh, yeah, we have plenty of analytics in the airline business these days. We have green screens, we call them, and avionics and fly-by-wire systems and so on. But he said, I still find it useful to look out the window every now and then. And so I think that's really what we have to do. We have to, you know, keep our eye on the computers and the instruments and so on, but also look out the window to say, is there really something happening here that makes these analytical tools not as useful as they might be? Is there a, you know, a black swan coming up, as Nassim Taleb calls it? You know, I think most swans are white, and so analytics in that sense, normal statistical distributions can be pretty useful, but there's sometimes when a normal distribution doesn't apply, and you need to have your eye out for those all the time.
What does the future hold for the use of strategic analytics? We will explore this area with Tom Davenport, co-author of Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.